of the latest economic snapshot.
One step forward, one step back.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles. Hello, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org. Today is Thursday, January 12th.
Well, Jeremy, times aren't so sweet for orange juice.
How different is presidential campaign cash from 4 years ago?
And later, fashion meets politics for some big bucks.
Those stories coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
The government said this morning the number of people seeking jobless benefits ticked up last week by more than 20,000 to 399,000. That's the most in 6 weeks. And another government report said retail sales inched up a tenth of 1% last month, which was enough to make 2011 a record-setting year.
Let's get reaction now from our regular Thursday guest, Diane Swank, chief economist with Mesirow Financial. She joins us from Chicago, as she always does. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what's the sale? What's the deal here with these retail sales figures? Best year ever?
Well, they certainly were the best on volume, and we did see them tick up a bit. But, of course, they didn't tick up more because it was all done on discount. Consumers were continuing to shop the sales and look for the best deals they could get. We also saw a lot of margin compression where people had to offer sales at the high-end luxury retailers because some of those Wall Street bonuses weren't as good as people had hoped for this year.
And as we look to 2012 for retail sales, I mean, I was driving by the mall the other day. It looked pretty empty. What do you think?
You know, January is a time when we tend to see some give back, although gift cards had extended the retail season, and now people are using the week after Christmas to really shop and get those sales and deals. And I think it's going to be a very tough uphill battle as we move into this year, especially with the layoffs that followed this retail season. We saw in the first week of January, layoffs increased quite a bit, particularly in the retail sector, and all those couriers and messengers. This was a big corporate retail Christmas. Corporations were willing to do a temporary thing and send out their gifts and deliver them, but that's not sustainable.
Well, is that why we're seeing this tick up in the people seeking jobless benefits?
Absolutely. We saw almost all in the private sector. In fact, we still got many of those postal workers to come, and the veterans started to abate in the numbers. But we are starting to see both retailers and, in particular, couriers and messengers can't maintain the kind of sales force that they thought they would during the holiday season.
Diane Swank, chief economist with Mesirow Financial. Thanks, as always.
Thank you.
All right, from retail sales and jobless claims to orange juice, OJ is trading at near record levels this morning, Jeremy, after some troubling news about Brazilian oranges. You heard about this fungicide,
sure,
right, that we're going to talk about here in just a moment. We're going to take, of course, it takes a while for that Brazilian news to sour prices here in the U.S. But what's happening with orange juice is a perfect example of what's happening in the global commodities market. And Marketplace's John Dimsdale is here with us to explain that story. Hey, John.
Good morning, Steve.
So explain to me, what's going on with the orange juice market in the first place?
Well, one trader is calling it the perfect storm. The weather in Florida, where most juice oranges are grown, has been really cold, close to freezing. And when that happens, many juice makers turn to imports from Brazil. But there's a problem there. The Food and Drug Administration has found traces of a fungicide that's used to combat mold. And there are rumors that the government might ban Brazilian imports and pull the existing imported juices from grocery shelves.
Mm. All right. So, John, why is orange juice so sensitive to these influences like weather and disease?
Well, it's a delicate fruit. California and Florida have the climate for it here. Brazil has the same climate in the southern hemisphere. And like many commodities, the price closely follows supply. But Kevin Kerr, an orange trader at Kerr International, a senior analyst at Money and Markets, says at some point, consumers push back against the cost.
There's an old saying, commodities trading, the cure for high prices is high prices. So, of course, if we see prices get too high, people are going to switch to alternatives. Orange juice is not a required staple for people to live. So they will turn to other things, and that will bring down prices eventually.
He says that when customers start drinking tomato juice instead, the cost of orange juice eventually will come back down.
All right. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reporting. John, thanks.
You're welcome.
Well, now to some good news from the Federal Reserve. The economy is improving in every region of the country, from Boston to Kansas City to San Francisco. That's the latest word from the Fed's Beige Book, which came out yesterday afternoon. And for those of you who are not familiar with the Beige Book, I don't blame you. But David Brancaccio from the Marketplace Economy 4.0 team is here to explain. He, of course, the 4.0 team looks at how the new economy can better serve more people. Hi, David.
Hello there.
So we've reported on the Beige Book before. Basically, it's a survey of business attitudes from around the country. How do they actually do it?
Yeah, it's put together by all 12 of the regional Federal Reserve banks, and we call to find out. They say they use technology to do this, a telephone mainly. They call business professionals, factory owners, economists, not with fancy social science questions. The Fed calls up and says, yo, what's up? How's things by you, or words to that effect. It's as simple as that. So easy that I thought I'd try to put together not a Beige Book, but my own Brancaccio Book.
I guess the first thing most people would say is it's terrible.
Yeah, that's Joey Sanchez, who runs Kaboots, a custom cowboy boot company in El Paso, Texas. Federal Reserve Region 11, by the way. So nothing scientific in these interviews, but you find out something useful about the economy.
The $500 boot or the, you know, the mid-price boot, that's not what's popping right now. It's a high-end boot.
A high-end Western boot's got fancy inlays, maybe something in alligator. He says are particularly popular with his high-end customers in Russia because they go for about $10,000 a pair. But the American middle class are still not doing much buying in their price range.
So from Federal Reserve Region 11, David, you find an interest in high-end shopping. What else?
So I check in on current business conditions in another Fed region, number two here in the East. I call up Kelly Conklin, who runs a custom cabinet-making factory in Bloomfield, New Jersey, Foley Weight Associates. The typical order he gets now...
Cabinetry for a library or an expensive dressing room, those would be one part of a through-gut renovation 5 years ago, and now it could be the whole project.
So signs of life he's seeing now, but what he told me the economy needs now is a sense of confidence. He brought up political gridlock in Washington as a barrier to confidence, and in the end, that's why I think the Fed's Beige Book, the real one, is actually a useful economic indicator. You can learn a lot from just asking.
Marketplace Economy 4.0 correspondent David Brancaccio. Thanks, David.
You bet.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
This week, Indiana became the latest state to make a deal with the online retailer Amazon involving the collection of sales tax. Online shopping is largely exempt from sales taxes, and cash-strapped states are trying to change that. So what did Indiana do? Well, let's bring in Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels, who's with us from Indianapolis, to explain. Good morning, Governor.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Well, how difficult was it for you to reach this deal with Amazon?
I wouldn't say it wasn't that difficult. It took a while to work out, but they were very cooperative. Deals aren't that hard when both parties start from the same premise, and we do, namely that the sales taxes that states impose ought to be paid and paid by everybody equally and collected by everybody in the retail business.
Amazon was on the same page with you? They think that these sales taxes should be collected?
They do, by everyone. You know, Amazon, being so successful and visible, has gotten a whole lot of the attention here. But, for instance, in Indiana's case, they represent at most maybe 20% of the uncollected, I usually say innocently evaded, sales taxes that are owed. You know, we're not talking about an additional or new tax here. We're talking about the collection of a tax that's existed a long time.
Well, what was it that you did here? Because state after state across the country has been dealing with Amazon and trying to figure out what to do to make this work. What was it that you did that other states can do to make a deal?
I'm not privy to conversations with other states, but maybe it's just that we did try to work constructively with them. Amazon has found Indiana four times now and a good place to invest. We are routinely now found to be one of the best business environments in the country, and so they've become familiar with our state. They employ several thousand Hoosiers, and maybe that set the stage for this unusually cooperative agreement.
Governor Mitch Daniels, Republican of Indiana, thanks so much for talking with us.
Okay, Jeremy, take care.
Now to Haiti, where 2 years ago today, a magnitude 7.0 earthquake killed an estimated 200,000 people or more and left more than $7 billion in damage. Now, aid from around the world has been pouring in ever since, billions of dollars worth of aid. And reporter Alex Goldmark this morning tells us from the capital, Port-au-Prince, about how some of that money is being spent.
The quake left 1.5 million people desperate for shelter, water, and health care. Charities and foreign governments promised some $6 billion for Haiti's recovery. Just a bit over half that's been spent. Jean Roca is with a UN project that scoops up the rubble of destroyed houses and recycles it into reusable brick. He says the job is about half done.
It is not yet finished, but he's not only arriving, demolishing, and going. He's understanding, making sure people accept us.
And getting 46 different agencies, the local government, and even local gangs to work together. And that's just for rubble. Mary Kate McIsaac is with the charity World Vision. It's trying to rebuild the 60% of Haiti's schools that were lost.
It's been difficult and it's a struggle. It continues to be a struggle for 500,000 people living in camps.
She says in Haiti, you can start to talk about progress now, but not success. In Port-au-Prince, Haiti, I'm Alex Goldmark for Marketplace.
To the Food and Drug Administration now, which is pulling some cups of soup, Steve. Mm-hmm. Some cups of rip-roaring crab soup coming off store shelves. There's nothing wrong with the soup exactly. It's the ingredient list on the crab soup that it has the problem.
Yeah.
It doesn't let customers know that the crab soup, called rip-roaring crab soup, has crab in it.
You mean it's been omitted?
It's been omitted from the ingredient list. I guess that was assumed, but not good enough for the FDA.
Mm. So really, there was no crab in it?
No, there is crab in the soup.
But it just doesn't label it.
It doesn't list that there's crab in it, so people that have crab allergies might not know.
Oh. Today we found out President Obama and the Democrats raised $68 million in the last quarter of 2011 as the president seeks re-election. But this money is a bit different. James Thurber heads up the Center for Congressional and Presidential Studies at the American University in Washington. Professor, thanks for being here.
Good to be here.
I know the president talked a lot about raising money from small donors 4 years ago. Where's this money coming from? Have his donors changed?
Well, his goal is $1 billion. He had 750 last time. His goal is to have small contributors. It's about 40% of the people contributing so far. So he's really meeting that goal so far.
I want to talk about the Supreme Court ruling on campaign finance, which essentially let sort of open the floodgates of all kinds of donations to come in politically. How much of a role has that played?
Citizens United was the decision, and it allows for so-called super PACs, which allows for unlimited contributions, and you really don't know who the contributors are until after the event. It is playing a major role in the Republican primaries. It'll play a major role in the general election.
Yeah. Are the Democrats using the same kind of methods? Are super PACs a big part of that race as well?
Super PACs have been started for the Democrats, but there's been a 2-to-1 expenditure of money from super PACs versus candidates so far in the Republican primaries. It will continue, and both Democrats and Republicans will use it no matter what the president says about big money in campaigns.
James Thurber from the American University. Professor, thanks.
Yes, thank you.
Well, presidential campaigns may be upbeat about their finances these days, so let's get an idea of how Americans feel about theirs.
And the latest poll number suggests
margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said.
Time once again for Attitude Check as we take America's temperature. And this morning, how folks are feeling about where they are in life economically compared to the last presidential election year. And Frank Newport is editor-in-chief of the polling firm Gallup. He's with us now. Hey, Frank.
Good morning.
You know, as Americans go to the polls, the question I think is being asked these days is, do people feel better today more than they did 4 years ago? How do they feel about that? What about the standard of living question?
You know, that's a great question, and that's going to change as the year goes on because the bottom fell out as 2008 went on. But at the beginning of the year, back in January of 2008, Americans were still fairly positive about their standard of living. And if you just look at where we are today, we are back to exactly that point. So you would say today we are where we were in January. But boy, by October of 2008, we only had 40% of Americans who said their standard of living was getting better, and it even went down to 32%. So as the year progresses, the comparisons are going to look better and better now because we have finally climbed back up to the point where we were when we started out.
I want to talk a little bit about the standard of living or quality of life issues. What do we include in sort of those issues and in those categories?
Yeah, you know, the question, of course, just says standard of living. So we'll let Americans kind of evaluate that as they would. But we know from a lot of different research that Americans do take into account health care, their overall income, and their family life and things along those lines. And Americans, generally speaking, now in particular, are fairly positive about how those things are going.
I know, Frank, they also talk about gas prices when they mention standard of living. And you know, there's a lot of instability going on in the Arab world right now, especially with tensions between the U.S. and Iran. How's that going at the moment?
We just got through asking Americans what's the most important problem facing the country. That's where we typically would see it. Only 1% told us that the big problem was oil and gas prices. And of course, that's been much higher historically. So far, we're not seeing that Americans are concerned about the price of gas. We'll monitor it, but it's not crept into the consciousness of the average Jane and John Doe yet out there across the country.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief over at Gallup. Frank, thanks.
You bet.
Top fashion designers are launching a campaign today called Runway to Win. They're donating custom T-shirts and other items to raise money for President Obama's reelection. But as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports, choosing candidates isn't something every company is comfortable doing.
Designer Marc Jacobs contributed to the fashion campaign, but the multinational that owns his namesake company did not. Luxury behemoth LVMH doesn't want to alienate customers by picking political sides in an election year.
LVMH wants to be friends of whoever wins, and they want their luxury goods and all of that to be part of any White House.
Adam Hanft helps companies develop their brands. He says many of the designers involved have dressed First Lady Michelle Obama.
It looks very opportunistic, and I don't think it's particularly good for their individual brand names.
Designer Prabal Gurung says his support has nothing to do with cozying up to President Obama.
The real American dream that everyone talks about happened to me. And, you know, as an immigrant to this country, I'm inspired by his story.
Gurung points out that some of his best customers are Republicans, but he doesn't worry about alienating them.
God forbid, they are the kind of people who are going to stop buying my clothes based on something that I believe in.
The campaign could generate more business from Democrats. On the Obama campaign website, one woman posted that she loves supporting the president by purchasing new clothes. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Well, Jeremy, we all know that hotels and restaurants, a lot of states will try all kinds of advertising ploys to get people to come visit, right?
Yep.
But sometimes you don't need ads. According to a recent article in the Vail Daily, some Colorado area resorts are seeing a big bounce in the number of reservations this week because of last weekend's Denver Broncos football game.
That's right. The game itself didn't really do anything, but people responded to the TV pictures of snow outside the stadium.
Yeah.
Ski resorts can see a big boost, apparently, when a big Denver Broncos game gets played in the snow and everyone sees all the fluffy powder on game day, and then they go, let's go skiing, honey.
It tantalizes
them,
doesn't it? Yeah. In today's Midday Extra, we look at whether there really is such a thing as a Broncos bounce, and here to talk with us about it is Bobby Bowers of Smith Travel Research. He joins us now from Nashville, Tennessee. Hey, Bobby.
Hey, guys. Good morning.
Good morning to you. Could this Broncos bounce theory really be true?
Well, I mean, I think there could be a little bit of credence to it. I mean, I think a lot of people pretty much have their ideas about where they want to travel and where they want to go, but you know, when they see stuff like nice snow and people having fun, or if it's like at a warm spot where you see the beaches or the boats out in the water and all that stuff, I think that could probably just spur them on just a little bit to say, hey, let's go ahead and maybe make this trip, you know?
Is this the same thing as if we see, you know, somebody eating a pizza on TV and then all of a sudden go out and order a pizza?
I think that's kind of the same thing. I mean, it's kind of like a subtle deal where you say, you know, I didn't really know that I needed that or I wanted that, but now that I see this guy, yeah, that might be a really good call, you know?
Is this, you think, a good advertising opportunity during the breaks from the football game, putting ads for ski resorts? You think that's something that they might think of doing down the road?
Oh, sure, sure. I mean, I think it's like, you know, like we're talking about. It could be ski resorts. It could be beach resorts. It could be wherever. I mean, you know, because right now I think that people kind of, especially at this time of year, you know, it's kind of after the holidays, people kind of got the blues, and you know, you say, okay, what can we do to kind of pick things up? And, you know, it might be a great opportunity to capitalize on that.
Capitalize, and you're seeing all that snow on the field in Denver, Mile High City, and there you go.
Exactly.
Is it more effective? Is it product placement? Is it more effective than actually having an ad on, though, to see it in real life behind the stadium?
I think it could be. I mean, I think the ads are good, but, you know, like you're talking about, I think when you see the real life deal and you get the shots of the people on the slopes or wherever it might be, I think that's probably as effective as any kind of ad that you might see.
You know, I remember the first time I came to L.A. and I saw a picture of downtown L.A. with the skyscrapers, and then in the background were the mountains, the San Gabriel Mountains with the snow on top.
Yeah,
and I was like, and it was the first time I scratched my head and I said, wow, there are mountains in L.A.?
Yeah,
you
don't see them very often.
No,
geez,
you don't. Because of the smog, anyway. You don't see them. Absolutely. Bobby Bowers, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, guys. Enjoyed it.
And finally this morning, Jeremy, a couple of big oops moments for a Lafayette, Louisiana man.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, he's charged with sticking up a convenience store. The man allegedly walked into the shop, grabbed a drink right out of the cooler, pulled out a gun, and demanded money from the cashier.
Hmm.
But when he went to drive away, oops, the thief realized he locked his keys in the getaway car, which then leads us to another oops moment.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, police picked up the thief, the suspect, in a parking lot while waiting for a spare key. Do you know who was bringing him his spare key?
His accomplice?
No. Well, perhaps that will be an accomplice.
Yeah.
Who knows? But it's his mother. His mother.
Oops.
Your mother can, mother comes to the rescue in all forms or fashions. She really must love her son. That's very nice. Anyway, in Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Enjoy your Thursday. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.